Joining us now on After Six, it's Gary Wolfram. He is a professor at Hillsdale College. He's in Michigan enjoying the delightful winter weather there. And he's thought out long enough to talk to us. Gary, welcome to WTIC.
Well, thanks for having me.
So we're going to talk about the new Democratic Party, which is a shockingly radical to a lot of people. But to me, I've always perceived this to be the what's below the surface and that they've never wanted to admit. But I always felt that at the root of it, there was a hostility towards capitalism and a discomfort with the idea of America, because America is the most powerful nation on earth and the most successful nation on earth and the most capitalist nation on earth. And all those things are somehow fingernails on the chalkboard to the left. What's your take on that, Gary?
Well, I think that one of the issues is they don't understand what capitalism truly is. Capitalism is not big government gets together with big business and starts regulations that favor them. Capitalism is a system of voluntary exchange where I can't force you to buy my stuff and you can't force me to buy your stuff. And it's a system where you have private property rights that are well-defined, and government is there is limited to the protection of life, liberty, and property. So actually in 1850, Frederick Bastiat wrote a book called The Law, and he said that once government engages in legalized plunder, that is, does it take from one person to give to another, or does it give one person advantage, he says the plundered classes will attempt to engage in the making of the law by violent or other means. Now, he was talking about violent revolutions going on in France at the time, but today that's made by lobbyists and corporations. What are they just trying to do? They're trying to just respond to the situation that we have where we've let government go on and do all sorts of things.
What would be the standout for you of the types of things that government does that is contrary to the notion of capitalism?
Oh, well, all you got to do is look at the Affordable Care Act. Why is it that the federal government should tell me what type of insurance I have to have? Why is it that the federal government should have all these regulations under the Dodd-Frank Act? The Affordable Care Act is pretty obvious, because all you got to do is start looking at all the paperwork and all the things that are required. You can't buy insurance across state lines. You can buy car insurance, but not health insurance across state lines. Why is it that it was the government that led to the situation where your health insurance is through your employer? I tell my students, when you go get a job, you're not going to ask, will they give you your fire insurance? Will they give you your car insurance? No, they give you health insurance. Why is that? It's not because Moses handed it down on the tablets, but it's because it goes back to wage and price controls and World War II, and then the tax treatment where it's deductible if it's presented by your employer, but it's not deductible if you buy your own insurance.
So, talking about capitalism, one of the things I've taken to say about it recently, and this only recently occurred to me, one of the things that frustrates me, you're an economist, and so your job is to get to the heart of what things are, and that's what I try to do, so that's why I wanted to talk to you. When I hear Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez or any of the other socialists speaking about their philosophy, it never makes any sense to me. And that what I've boiled it down to is this, and tell me if this makes sense, that the ultimate democratic value, if you believe in democratic values, which the left says they do all the time, the ultimate democratic value is capitalism. That is, a dollar spent is a vote for a certain response in the marketplace. And only through this kind of real-time give and take between the marketplace and citizens do you get the process and the progress that you need to have. If you have a special interest group like education unions controlling policy in education, you've dismantled democratic values. And if you have that special interest group, that union, rigging elections with a particular political party with whom they've formed a power partnership, you're denying democratic values. So I find it really effective to use this argument to clarify for people like family members who are horrified that I believe in the American system of government and the U.S. Constitution. So give me your thoughts along there and see if you can enhance my thinking or my language at all.
Oh, you're right. The market system is designed to produce what consumers want. They're the ones that decide what's to be produced, how it's to be produced, all through their interactions in the price system, what Hayek called a spontaneous order. I tell my students, like 9 million people woke up in New York City today and there was exactly the right amount of Starbucks coffee and exactly the right amount of peanuts and exactly the right amount of bagels and exactly the right amount of toilet paper.
And what an extraordinary achievement that is.
It's an extraordinary. In fact, I tell them, look, you should wake up every day and be astonished that that happens, because there is no central planner in charge of all that. And if you take a place like Venezuela, where you have a central planner in charge, what do? You get shortages of everything. You get shortages of food. You have 3 million people that have fled from Venezuela, which should be one of the wealthiest countries, should be one of the wealthiest countries in South America, maybe one of the wealthiest countries in the world. But the way it organized themselves makes it so that they live in dire poverty. In fact, Mises argues that, very correctly, that the only way to create wealth for the masses is through market capitalism. So those that favor capitalism are really favoring wealth for the poor.
Well, a lot of people will be shocked by that, Gary. How does capitalism deliver wealth to the poor? I thought by being poor, that would de facto prove that capitalism doesn't deliver wealth to the poor.
Well, think about this. If I say to you, okay, I'm God, I'm going to place you in any country in the world that you want. You're going to be born any country that you want. But the caveat is you're going to be the poorest person there. You're not going to pick, oh, I'm going to be the poorest person in Venezuela. I want to be the poorest person in Cuba. I want to be the poorest person in North Korea. You're clearly going to pick countries.
Imagine being the poorest person in North Korea.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. So that makes the point. Go ahead, finish.
Well, there are two indices of economic freedom, one put out by the Fraser Institute and one put out by the Heritage Foundation, where they rank countries based on how close they are to free markets. And if you look at the Fraser Institute's study, you look at the bottom 10% of the income distribution, okay, who's poor, it turns out that you're 11 times wealthier to be poor in a country in the top 25% of the index of economic freedom than you are in the bottom 25%.
So if you're impoverished in America, it's safe to assume that you are in the 1% of impoverished people on the planet.
Oh, no question. In fact, even just think historically. I asked my students, do you want to be King of England in 1263 or do you want to be yourself? And they're looking around and going, well, you know, at 17 below, indoor plumbing is really something I would like to have. They always pick themselves. I mean, why is that? Because the feudal system was not a very efficient way of creating goods for the poor.
I love that example. You know, my idea of what a king was in the era you're talking about is he was basically using the entire infrastructure of the capable people in his country to give him, to deliver to him the lifestyle that a poor person has in this country today.
Oh, a poor person in this country today has a much better lifestyle than...
I just mean in terms of, you know, if you don't have a flush toilet, but you have the same result because there's a bunch of people around to make it happen for you?
Yeah, I guess... I did watch Monty Python's Holy Grail to see what it was like, but I didn't see that part. But
all right, we're talking with Gary Wolfram. He's an economics professor at Hillsdale College. So let's focus on the funny left a little bit, because just to hold people's attention before we get too wonkish. What is your reaction to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the new congresswoman from Queens?
Well, she clearly is appealing to people who don't think through how the market system works. If what you do is you say, oh, we're going to provide free health care for everybody, we're going to provide free education for everybody, then the question is, okay, we have what economics calls an opportunity cost. That is, I can't use resources to do two things, right? You're either going to use the resource to make this or to make that. And that means that if you use the resources to produce healthcare for everyone free of charge, then they're going to demand healthcare that until their marginal benefit is zero. And what will happen is we're going to be giving up other things because the resources that go into healthcare cannot be used to go into anything else.
Now, wait a sec. I was listening to a podcast today with three really smart leftists, and they were mocking a similar kind of point made by the former CEO of Starbucks, Howard Schultz, who's announcing his exploration of a presidential run as an independent, and they're in such a tizzy over it. And they were making the argument that if you are taking what we're a segment of the economy that we now spend 17% of our GDP on and transfer that 17% of the economy into a different system, then you should get much better results because you're doing it. It's being paid for. It's not new money. We're already overpaying compared to the rest of the world. So that 17% might come down to 14% and suddenly we become a richer nation. What's wrong with that argument?
Well, that argument's exactly correct. But the way you ought to do it is to allow the private sector to produce health care. I mean, think about how Medicare works, which is a $700 billion program. The way it works is, what do I have the incentive to do? I have the incentive to come up with a program that's very expensive that Medicare will pay for, regardless if it increases people's health. And if it's cheaper, they don't care because they're not paying for it. I say to my students, look, when you go to dinner and you're gonna pay for dinner, when you tell the people that you're picking up the tab, and the answer is after they've ordered.
Yeah, right? A lot fewer steaks get ordered.
And so what happens today is not only are you told they're picking up the tab, they tell the waiter you're picking up the tab. The waiter brings out the $150 bottle of wine, right? Because so the resources get so misallocated in the healthcare system because government is interfering so much in the healthcare system. Now, the market has been responding with these concierge ways of buying, healthcare.
For people with money to escape, and then those doctors who have that command over their clientele, I would assume the best doctors, opt out of taking the government programs.
Well, it turns out that it's way cheaper to get the concierge care. Because they don't take insurance. So it turns out, because now if I have to choose between Dr. A and Dr. B, and Dr. A is going to charge me $5 for a blood test, and the doctor, the next doctor is going to charge me $50 for the blood test, I'll choose the doctor that has the lowest cost. So it would be an incentive to make healthcare services that are low cost and provide quality care. There's very little incentive under the current system to do that.
Why is that? What happened to calling up a doctor and saying, how much does it cost, or your referring doctor, to say to you, would you go here and get the CAT scan because it saves us $500? We'll buy you a gift certificate for dinner if you do that. Like, where is that common sense instinct in our system?
And the problem is because you've created this whole system that is totally inefficient in terms of using resources and is driven by incentives that are that basically go in the wrong direction. The incentive, as I said, is to make something that's really expensive, and it doesn't matter whether it does that good a job or not because Medicare is going to pay for it or Medicaid is going to pay for it. The private sector in moving towards health savings accounts, that has worked that's worked in the right direction, because if you have, $1,500 in your health savings account, you're going to start asking, okay, does it cost that much here or that much there? Is this going to come out of that? So health savings accounts, I mean, really, that's the way we ought to do Medicare and Medicaid, is we ought to turn them into health savings.
Give people a budget for each year, and then they can go shop. But we're talking with Gary Wolfram. He's a professor of economics at Hillsdale College. It's Wolfram. Your two animals combined, Gary. I'm sure that's occurred to you.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
There are even states where it's against the law, or there's some kind of institutional resistance to revealing what the cost of things are. And what I've been told is that's because of government laws, that government rules or regulations or laws have designed the system to protect it from those very mechanisms that would create competition and hold down costs.
Sure. If what happened was you bought health insurance the same way that you bought life insurance, there'd be a way more transparency. And you would notice that you wouldn't lose your insurance if you lost your job, as long as you kept making the premiums. The way insurance works today is you can't be denied use of a, if you have a pre-existing condition. Well, because your insurance was tied into your job, so if you lose your job, you can't go out and buy insurance against diabetes if you already have it. So the whole system just kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger, whereas if you had, you know, if you're of life insurance and you're paying your premiums, you don't lose your life insurance if you get diabetes. So we ought to really just make the health insurance system the way we have car insurance and life insurance and fire insurance and home insurance.
It's a totally bizarre system, what you're describing. And I've always wondered how it got to be that way and why it's that way. And I realized eventually that it was because of government intervention, that government designed this system. Through its rules and its laws, they have made a mess of it. And also as a big buyer of health services. So my understanding is that when you go to the doctor as a Medicare patient, that Medicare reimburses the doctor at a rate of 65 cents or 70 cents on the dollar. And then the doctors are out there looking for that money. They need to replenish the one-third empty pot because they've took the government customer. And they take that need for money out to the marketplace. Is that fair?
Sure. And what it does is it raises the prices for everybody else. And now, if you're, I've always found it interesting, go ask somebody that's on Medicaid and say, wow, you're really happy with that insurance? You're really happy with how you get treated by Medicaid? And I will bet you most of them will say, no, I can't find a doctor. I have huge, you know, waiting in line, et cetera. And because they don't reimburse at the rate that they would get from somewhere else. And so, Hillsdale College has online courses, and I did one, I think it's called Constitution and Economic Controversies or something like that. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I did the one on healthcare. And you might want to, you know, if you're interested in this, get on Hillsdale College's website and go to online courses. And
that's hillsdale.edu.
Yes. Yep. And you know, actually, while we're at it, I now that I think about it, I have a contest with John Miller, who teaches journalism here.
Oh, good.
And it's to who has the most Twitter followers.
Uh-huh.
And he pulled away from me about a month ago. So if your listeners will follow me on Twitter, it's Gary_Wolfram. Then I will get a free lunch from John Miller next week.
And will that be one in which the waiters will know in advance
right.
that he's picking up the
tab? We set a maximum on it, though.
Oh, too bad. All right, so your Twitter handle is @Gary_Wolfram, the two animals put together, Wolfram.
Yeah.
And you're at Hillsdale College economics professor. It's really fun to talk with you. I wonder if you'll be willing to come back again.
Oh, sure. Anytime.
And I'll make a regular point of promoting your Gary_Wolfram
yeah,
Twitter handle, and I will follow you as well.
John Miller won't figure out what the heck happened.
All right. Thank you so much for your time.
All right. Well, thank you.
It's great to meet you. Gary Wolfram from Hillsdale College. On Twitter, follow him @Gary_Wolfram. And we'll talk to you again soon. Thanks, Gary. Todd Feinberg here. That was Gary Wolfram from Hillsdale College. I like his vibe. I like his energy. And, of course, I like the politics of the people from Hillsdale. So I'm going to try to get more of them on. Stay tuned. We've got more After 6 coming up after news with former Senator Len Suzio. Stay right here on WTIC News Talk 1080.